drop. Washington has fallen ill, Alexander said glumly. They say it's anthrax. I worry for the man, of course, but more than that, too. What comes of the Constitution if he dies?
Madison's expression was equally grim.
The crisis this could bring about in our public affairs may be insurmountable.
It was already bad enough, he explained, that our countrymen were getting into tavern brawls over whether we should prefer to trade with the British or the French. The only thing everyone agreed on was George Washington.
If Washington dies, we're to entrust the whole enterprise of the federal government to a man lambasted as his rotundity, the Duke of Braintree?
John Adams, he meant. And yet, was the possibility of the president's death not the entire purpose of having a vice president? So my prayers when I made them were not for the Constitution. I prayed for the president and for Martha Washington. Because how would she bear it if her husband were to die? Leaving the men to talk, I sent Jenny to fetch more water and cut lemons to fill a pitcher for more lemonade. All this before greeting Angelica at the front door and hefting 14-month-old James into my lap to nurse. I told my sister the news, then shook my head. Mrs. Washington must be frantic. I should like to visit her to offer comfort or assistance. I'll go with you, Angelica said. But I wondered if a visit with the president's lady was truly possible. Because Mrs. Washington's position meant things had changed between us. At her receptions, I always found the president's lady seated atop a dais, her round face smiling benevolently down upon us, from beneath a modest powdered coiffure and lace veil. And there she regally received each lady in turn. The first time I'd seen her that way, I realized with a start that Martha Washington and I might never again be easy and familiar together. She was the closest thing we had to royalty. There must be a distance now, I thought, almost sadly. And as I made my way to the dais to present myself, I'd been acutely aware that I'd never attended a royal court. I hadn't known how low to drop or how long I ought to hold the curtsy. In the end, I'd grasped my skirts and endeavored to a posture between obsequiousness and mere respect, hoping, quite sincerely, that I wouldn't somehow teeter off my embroidered silk shoes. Much to my relief, when I rose, Mrs. Washington's smile had widened. Almost a secret message just for me, as if to reassure me that a friendship remained. But that friendship would never be the same because she was now, more than ever, a public figure. Every gesture and smile a reflection upon her husband until the day he died, which, I prayed, would not be soon. President Washington simply must recover. Angelica decided, making herself helpful by brushing little Fanny's curly hair. And he will. At the inaugural ball, he looked as strong and vigorous as ever. So right now, I refuse to worry about anything but you. She nodded toward the babe at my breast. I don't know how you manage all this. And you're expected to host a dinner tonight besides? I nodded, eyeing a gown piled atop the chair that I needed to mend before I could wear it. Some gentlemen are coming to arrange for the care of Alexander's legal practice when he takes up his new position. Angelica sighed. This won't do. It's too much for you without more servants. It's too much for Jenny. It isn't seemly for the wife of such an important man to scrub floors next to her maid. It wouldn't be fitting for the president's lady to stoop to it. In light of the current crisis, I could scarcely imagine such a position. Certainly, I didn't want to imagine it. I am not the president's lady, but you might be one day, my sister replied with a sly smile. My mouth went dry, for the situation cast Angelica's comment in a too calculating light that made me uneasy. And it was more proof that, though I was coming to better understand my husband's ambitions, sometimes it seemed as if my sister sympathized with those ambitions more than I did. I didn't want to be the wife of the Secretary of the Treasury, much less the President's wife, and I shuddered to think I might ever find myself in Martha Washington's position, especially given what she was facing now. Perhaps sensing my panic at the idea, Angelica sighed and said, "Oh, Betsy, you blanch when you should blaze. If Hamilton must entertain, have him take his guests to my lodgings, where servants can wait upon them, as befitting the household of a great man." Oh, the relief of that idea. I couldn't deny that the elegance of my sister's household was more in keeping with expectations, to say nothing of the absence of children, chickens, and monkeys. Though, on this particular afternoon, with such grave news hanging over our heads, the monkey looked to be having a salutary effect on the men. For when I went out to refill their glasses, I found my husband and Mr. Madison, heads close together, laughing and teasing the creature as it swung from the tree by its tail and pelted them with leaves.
"Where did the little devil come from?"
Madison wanted to know.
"Our neighbor won the monkey from a sailor in a card game,"
my husband explained.
"A British sailor or a French sailor?"
Madison asked archly, as if ready to come to fisticuffs about it. Whereupon they both laughed, before their conversation turned to finance and Alexander's upcoming position, topics that had me retreating back into the house. The next afternoon, Angelica and I tried to call upon Mrs. Washington, only to be denied access, as I feared. The street had been roped off so that carriages would not disturb the president's rest. I returned home early, dejected, only to find the house strangely empty and quiet. "Jenny?" I called. But when I had no answer, I guessed she must have gone to the market. It was too soon for Alexander to be home, and yet from up the narrow stairway, I heard my husband's voice, soft and tender, speaking of love. Not stopping to remove my hat and gloves, I climbed the stairs and cautiously pushed open the door. There, I found Alexander seated on the floor of our bedroom, rocking little Fanny in his arms where she slept, his lips pressed to her hair as he murmured that he would love and care for her. "What's happened?" I asked. "Has she fallen ill, too?" Hamilton didn't look up. Perhaps he couldn't.
"Her father is dead."
"Oh, poor orphaned girl." I didn't ask how. I supposed it didn't matter. What did matter was that my grief-stricken husband looked nearly as broken and vulnerable as when he'd received the news of John Lawrence's death. His voice catching, Alexander said,
"Her sisters are still too young and impoverished themselves to take care of her. I know it's too much to ask."
I knelt and pressed my forehead to his. "You needn't ask. We'll keep her. We'll love her as our very own. Why, with those bright black eyes of hers, Fanny could pass for my daughter." He peered at me, tearily.
"I fear it's too much of a burden on you, my love."
"A small burden when compared to the ones you shoulder," I said. For it was in his pain for this little girl, and the obligation he felt toward her, that I finally understood his calling. Not just to help provide a future for the child of one fallen comrade, but to provide for the children of all of them, the ones who had been orphaned in a war he helped unleash, in battles he helped plan, and mutinies he put down. He was, I knew, trying to keep the promise he made to make this a better world. And I felt sympathy for all that my husband was trying to do. Fortunately, by the grace of God, the skill of the doctors, and the stoic disposition of the president, George Washington survived his ordeal that summer. But the scare made us all realize how much the country needed this man. And I embraced the fact that the country needed Alexander Hamilton, too.
With special trust and confidence in the patriotism, integrity, and abilities of Alexander Hamilton of the City of New York in the State of New York, I have nominated, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, do appoint him Secretary of the Treasury of the said United States. George Washington. September 13, 1789, New York City. Dinner parties and balls filled our evenings, now that Alexander was a member of Washington's new cabinet, and at every one I reveled in having Angelica's tutelage in becoming the socialite wife of an important man. I studied my sister as she conversed in French, made literary allusions, shared gossip, always the gentlest kind, and carried herself with an air of dignity and charm. And while the wit and guile of society would never come as a natural talent to me, I began to understand it as a craft that could be practiced, especially when I had such a good and loving teacher as my sister. But our celebrations were abruptly cut off by a pair of unexpected blows. After 7 months in New York, Angelica received word that her children were ill. Frantic to hold her babies in her arms, even if it meant returning to John Church, my sister made haste to sail back to England. An ocean would again separate us, and she'd be in her husband's grasp. He could keep Angelica from us forever if he wanted. That was a husband's power. And I was devastated to think I might never see her again. "Take heart, my angel," Alexander said to soothe me. "Your sister wants to live here in America, near to us, and she is precisely the sort of woman who knows how to get her way." He meant to make me laugh at the idea that it was Angelica who would make Church bend to her will, as she so easily bent everyone else to it. But I couldn't even smile. What if her ship is lost? What if... 1,000 calamities seemed possible. But I cut myself off from expressing any of them when my sister's carriage pulled up in front of our house. I did my best to dry my eyes, wipe my tears. But when she'd finished kissing all my children farewell, Angelica drew me aside and smoothed at my cheeks with her thumbs. "You've been crying." "No," I said, trying to be brave for her sake. "I really hoped I'd taught you to lie better than that," she said, a little teary herself. "Your eyes are bloodshot and your nose is red, and my heart is breaking to leave you. I know you must go for your children's sake, but I'm going to miss you terribly. I've been so happy these months. We've all been so happy together. And now, what will I do?" "Now you will shine, Betsy. You'll become all you were meant to be. You and Hamilton both. And I couldn't be prouder of either of you. You're making a new country, and I'm only sorry I cannot stay to be a part of it." Angelica was proud of me. I hadn't realized until that moment how much I had longed to hear it. And my lower lip began to wobble until she said, "Oh, you really must stop looking at me that way. You're going to make me cry too, and it will ruin my powder." For her powder's sake, and for my own dignity, I didn't dare see her off at the pier. Instead, we said our farewells in my parlor, and then my husband, young Philip, and the Baron took her to the ship. Meanwhile, I retreated to bed, filled with an ache in my heart and my head. That night, my husband was forced to finish the letter to Angelica that I'd started, sharing in my misery at her departure. As if the loss of her was as genuine a wound for him as it was for me, which made me love him even more.
"I fear I've lost an ally, not to mention a friend,"
he confided one morning soon after. Fighting my own fears that I would never see my sister again, I whispered upon our pillow, "She will always be an ally, always your friend, always your sister, even if an ocean away."
With a huff, Alexander clamored from the bed. "I meant Madison. I would never have accepted this office if I didn't believe I had his firm support."
"Jemmy Madison, not now just a congressman from Virginia, but the most influential congressman besides, had unexpectedly pulled his support from Alexander's financial plans. On top of the loss of my sister, Madison's desertion was as depressing as it was confusing.
Did he say why?
He thinks it unjust that speculators might get a windfall from buying up debt from ignorant country folk. But that's just how investment works.
He's letting Jefferson's ideas about the nobility of the simple yeoman farmer sway him away from financial reality.
Jefferson had only recently returned from his post as minister to France to take a new position in the president's cabinet. But already Alexander was wary of Jefferson's influence, and perhaps he was right to be. Jemmy seemed to idolize his fellow Virginian, with whom he shared a friendship long before we met. I had worried once before that Jefferson might come between Madison and my husband, and it was vexing to think my fears could be coming true. How many times had I hosted Jemmy Madison in my home? How many times had I admired his tender touch with my children? He became a friend to me. Worse, I realized belatedly, he'd become a brother to Alexander. So the relationship simply must be salvaged. Trying to soothe my husband's temper over breakfast, I pointed out, Madison opposes only part of your plan, doesn't he? Hamilton rattled off a list of reasons why even that disagreement was intolerable. Debt and credit are an entire thing. Every part of it relies on every other part. Wound one limb and the whole tree shrinks and decays, he said, waving an impatient hand. No, Jemmy's opposition to me is a perfidious desertion of the principles he was solidly pledged to defend. I let him vent his spleen, and with Mrs. Washington's wise advice in mind, I tried another tactic. That my husband was a man of studied principles, I knew without question. But I also wished that he could occasionally muster a modicum of forbearance for the foibles of others, one that might preserve one of the most important friendships in our new nation, just this once. So, Madison has been corrupted, I asked.
My husband slanted me a glance. I wouldn't go so far as that.
He's a madman, then. One day, working with you side by side, then changing his mind on a lunatic whim.
Alexander didn't answer, which was, in itself, a concession. And when I noticed Jenny smirk knowingly as she refilled his coffee cup, I pressed the point.
Did Mr. Madison hit his head and damage his brilliant faculties?
Hamilton grumbled. You make too much of his faculties. Although Madison is a clever man, he is very little acquainted with the world.
That may be true, but it is still no personal opposition to you. What reason would he have, other than a difference of opinion?
I let the question hang there, as Hamilton finally calmed enough to resume eating the stewed apples on his plate.
He has no personal reason to oppose me. None that he should be aware of, anyway.
He said the last quietly, in a nearly absent fashion, then winced, as if he'd not meant to speak it aloud.
My raised eyebrow must have demanded an explanation, because he sighed.
Last year, when Madison introduced his foolish ideas about the Tariff Act, I whispered in a few ears and made some obstacles for him. Perhaps he found me out.
Oh, Alexander. My husband was a strategist, and the legislature was his game board.
He was certainly not the only one to engage in backstage dealing, and his machinations were more honorable than most.
This wasn't the first time his secret schemes created mistrust amongst friends, but there was nothing to be done for it now. What does the president say?
He urges me to compromise with Madison.
I smiled, as so often George Washington and I saw things in the same way. So then do that, Alexander. I'll host a dinner, I suggested. It would be a great deal easier if Madison had a wife, the friendship of women being a necessary lubricant to remedy social frictions.
But the Virginian was too mannerly to refuse our hospitality, and I felt certain we could win him back.
I know just the occasion. A party for the new Secretary of State.
Lately arrived from France, Thomas Jefferson appeared worldly and elegant in a fashionable dove-gray satin coat and fine French lace cravat as he presented himself at my threshold. His tall frame filled the doorway, making Madison seem even shorter by comparison.
"Secretary Jefferson, what a pleasure it is to see you again," I said, welcoming the man in from the October chill. "And Mr. Madison, it's been too long."
"Your invitation was most welcome, Mrs. Hamilton," Jefferson said with a little bow.
Wisps of silver shot through the Virginian's ginger hair, but otherwise he looked much the same as he had all those years before in Philadelphia. Madison bowed too, and spoke with even more formal reserve than normal, a thing that concerned me.
"Mrs. Hamilton, thank you, as always, for your hospitality."
"Of course," I said, showing them into the dining room, where I'd worried over every detail. Angelica had told me that Jefferson was a connoisseur of fine wine, so I had Papa come and bring his best Madeira. I knew, too, that the new Secretary of State ate little meat, so I planned a menu with an abundance of peas, greens, and vegetables of every variety. I had Jenny set the table with my finest dishes, and everything was so perfect that Angelica would have been proud of me.
"Mr. Jefferson, how is your lovely daughter, Patsy?" Jefferson's smile revealed great fatherly pride.
"Patsy has recently married. She's Mrs. Randolph now."
"Well, then we shall add that happy occasion to our list of things to toast this evening," I said.
"A happy occasion indeed, madam," said Jefferson, just as Alexander entered the room and greeted our guests.
Though Jefferson accepted the seat of honor at the table when my husband made a show of offering it, he said,
"Please, there's no need for formality among old friends, which I feel us all to be, given our past acquaintance and all your sister-in-law has told me of you. In fact, Mrs. Church sent as a gift to me a copy of The Federalist that your amiable wife inscribed for her."
Perhaps it was my own vanity in remembering my part in the publication of those essays that made me ask, "Have you had the opportunity to read them?"
"Indeed," Jefferson said with a smile. "I found it to be the best commentary on the principles of government ever written."
The praise should have made Alexander smile, but neither Madison nor my husband seemed at ease. Fortunately, Jefferson's good social graces smoothed things over quickly, and he and Alexander fell into such deep discussion and swift agreement about coins and the mint that they did indeed seem like old friends. I was glad for that, but the true aim of the occasion was to mend fences with Jemmy Madison, who hung on Jefferson's every word. When Madison's eyes lifted to the ceiling at a particularly loud shriek from the children's nursery, I moved in to say,
"My apologies. I believe that's my daughter. I'm told that little girls are soft and manageable creatures, but mine has a war cry that would make an Iroquois chief proud."
Madison chuckled at that, but no more. The man had accepted my invitation as I knew he would. Yet again and again, I found it difficult to draw Jemmy into conversation. How had a political disagreement about economic policy so chilled our friendship? Perhaps Alexander was right, and Madison had learned about my husband's machinations against his tariff. While I worried for Madison's mood, Jefferson opined on the virtues of the French people.
"I've been fortunate to see in the course of 14 years... 2 revolutions as the world has never seen before."
Jefferson had a way with words that excited within me the idea that we were living in extraordinary times. My husband, by contrast, seemed less inspired by France's attempts to throw off their monarchy.
"As a friend to mankind and liberty, I rejoice in the efforts," Alexander said, but I fear much for the fate of those caught up in it.
Specifically, we worried that harm would come to our friend Lafayette, who was championing the revolution in France. We knew the righteousness of his cause, but the stories of violence in Paris frightened me. I did not believe the French nobles would give up their privileges so easily, and it seemed to me as if the French revolutionaries themselves were beginning to fracture into dangerous rivalries. But Jefferson sipped appreciatively at the Madeira and asked,
"Why should you fear it, Secretary Hamilton?"
To my great vexation, my husband's eyes traveled the length of the table and settled on Madison.
"Because we should all dread destructive and petty disagreements amongst those who once stood united."
My wine lodged itself in my throat, and only with a cough and some difficulty did I manage to swallow. If I'd learned anything about Virginians, it was that a thing must be approached with them from the side. So why did my husband insist upon a frontal assault? Hadn't my work in hosting this party been aimed at Alexander's reconciliation with Madison? If not out of regard for their friendship, then at least in consideration of the fact that he was the one man who could thwart my husband's plans? Mr. Jefferson smiled indulgently, appearing to take no notice of the undercurrents. But there was a shrewdness in his eyes that made me think he missed nothing.
"I think the present disquiet in France will end well. The nation has been awakened by our revolution. They feel their strength. They are enlightened. Their lights are spreading, and they will not retrograde."
His words caused a swell of patriotism within my breast. I have always believed our revolution would be a force of good in the world, that all our suffering and privations would mean more than a new nation for us, but also a new age for mankind. And I thought that Jefferson, a man with such vision, should be a natural ally for my husband. Surely he would understand the magnitude of what Alexander was trying to do, and help in it.
"Well said, Mrs. Hamilton."
Jefferson gave an extraordinarily sunny smile that filled me with pride. I was, in fact, so swept up in Jefferson's idealism and charm that I understood how Madison could be enthralled by the force of that man's character and charisma. Though I didn't know it then, that force, which made Jefferson so effective as the voice of our revolution, and so rousing as a politician and the father of a political party, was something, like love, quite beyond reason. Like the Earth's own poles, Jefferson and my husband had the power to both repel and attract, and I realize now that Madison was trapped between them, pulled to Jefferson as much or maybe even more by that force of charisma as by any alignment of their ideals. But at the time, I only knew that I wanted these men to remember all they had in common, and I lifted my glass in abandonment of all etiquette. To the revolution, to independence, and the Constitution, and to the men at this table, all of whom made them possible. At that, Madison seemed to soften, giving me a private little nod as he joined in the toast. Alexander seemed more cordial, too.
"And to the women as well," he said generously. "The good feelings that finally surround us persuaded me to henceforth adopt a policy for the dinners that took place at my table. No man's politics should be held against him, and all were welcome."
Conversation flowed with more ease after that, and when Hamilton saw Madison and Jefferson out, he made an invitation of his own.
"Gentlemen, let's do this again. Just the three of us. I have some thoughts on the matter of a national capital. Perhaps we can reach a compromise."
Chapter 21. November 1790, Philadelphia. Over a second private dinner of just the three of them, they'd struck a bargain. A grand compromise. Madison yielded, agreeing to get my husband the votes he needed for his financial plan. And on the heels of his victory, Alexander brimmed with excitement, swooping little James into his arms to spin him around. But I was too much the daughter of a Dutchman to think such a victory would come without a price. And what do the Virginians want in exchange? Alexander was suddenly, decidedly less giddy.
I agree to use my influence to move the capital city from New York to the wilderness of the Potomac.
Already imagining the uproar it would cause amongst our New York friends, I tried to reconcile myself to the news. It will take time to build a new city. Surely, in the meantime, we'll remain here. Hamilton shook his head, more than a little frustrated at the outcome. His enemies had whispered that the capital city was to be called Hamiltonopolis, so he'd been forced to give New York up, even as a temporary home for the government, lest he appear to be self-interested. All of us, the congressmen, the senators, the cabinet officers and their wives, are to pack up and migrate to Philadelphia.
I didn't relish upending our life on Wall Street, but there was nothing for it but to close up the house, pack up the children, and sell the chickens. But that autumn, with the move entirely in my command, I was inconsolable. Not to leave New York, but because our faithful Jenny fell prey to yellow fever. It had started as a fever and some aches, and though she insisted she felt better, I sent her back to the pastures for a rest and a visit with her mother. She never made it there. She died on the sloop, it was reported to me, bleeding from the mouth, nose, and eyes, screaming in pain. And I grieved as much that she had died alone without me to tend her, as I would have for a member of my family, which made me deeply ashamed. For I had not treated her with the love and respect someone ought to treat family. Instead, I'd told myself polite lies to disguise the fact that I'd borrowed Jenny. I'd taken her away from her mother at the pastures, and I'd taken her labor and kindness as if I had a right to them. Jenny had been a servant, yes. Why say it politely, even if it was the custom? She was a slave. She'd been my children's nursemaid, and they loved her. She'd also been my helpmate, and I considered her a friend. I should have told her that. No, I should have treated her like a friend. I should have treated her like a person, with the same God-given rights as any other. I should have seen to her freedom. And now it was too late. Papa had joined the New York Manumission Society. He wasn't insensible to the injustice of slavery. He meant to do away with it at the pastures as soon as he could afford to. But even if Papa wouldn't have released Jenny from bondage, I should have paid her a wage. In guilt and grief over her death, I wanted nothing more to do with slavery. Now I vowed never to own, rent, or borrow another human being. That wasn't enough, of course. Not enough to wipe away the stain on my soul, or the everyday injustices of the institution. But I kept true to my vow. I'd been born and raised on a plantation. My happiness had been built on the subjugation of others. My past was tainted with it, no matter what excuses I made for myself. But I could change. The country could change. So I put slavery and New York behind me, in the hopes of bringing about a government that would help guarantee that all men, and perhaps all women, would be treated as equals before the law. Determined to make a fresh start in our new capital, we found ourselves renting a home in Philadelphia on the corner of Walnut and Third Streets, not far at all from the theater. Our neighbors were thee and thou Quakers, including Mrs. Dolly Payne Todd, who welcomed us with a warm apple pie from her kitchen. Like my husband, I admired Quaker morals and their anti-slavery stance. But upon hearing of our move, Peggy had complained about Quakers having humorless pretensions to gravity and ostentatious plainness. I thought she'd change her mind if she ever met the vivacious young Mrs. Todd, who even then had such an impeccable sense of style that her dark workaday frock gave the impression of good fashion,
its somber hues lightened by a smattering of whimsical Swiss dots. In any case, I was grateful for the pie and the knowledge of a friendly face only a block away on Walnut Street, where, rising up from the red-bricked streets, our snow-dusted stylish new abode was enclosed by a wrought-iron gate, leading to a yard that provided more than enough elbow room for children, chickens, or even monkeys if we should want them. Much more in keeping with the style to which you grew accustomed as General Schuyler's daughter, my husband boasted as he showed me into the drawing room, where some expensive French chairs were already invitingly arranged by the fireplace. And best of all, only a block from the new treasury, such as it is. Alexander was so very proud of himself that I couldn't help but set down my bags, straighten my bodice, and give him a very proper kiss. Well, then, what is to prevent you from tumbling from our bed straight into the chair at your office without so much as running a comb through your hair? I said it only to twit him, but it wasn't far from the truth in the months that followed, where our lovely new house became little more than the place Alexander Hamilton slept, when he slept at all. My husband's mind was filled with the details of establishing American commerce. At breakfast, he muttered about lighthouses, beacons, and buoys. At lunch, if he came home for lunch, it was talk of coins, candle wicks, wool, and manufactures. And before bed, it was banks and paper instruments and international trade. Yet despite the demands of his position, the gay social life of Philadelphia seemed poised to bring us happiness, especially when we were joined in the new capital just in time for the holiday by James Monroe, who now served as a senator from Virginia. I ran into Monroe almost quite literally at a coffee house, which made us both laugh. With the rich scent of beans making our mouths water, he gave me a flourishing bow. "Can it really be you, Miss Schuyler, still bundled up against the cold, pink-cheeked and bright-eyed as you were all those years ago when I served you swill in a military camp?" Grinning, I nodded. "Yes, but I remind you that I'm Mrs. Hamilton now, as you well know, and as a mother of five, I fear I am very much changed from those days." Monroe kissed my hand in courtly and proper fashion. "Well, I do declare you are as lovely as ever, second only to my own Elizabeth." A moment later, the beautiful Elizabeth Courtright Monroe emerged from a circle of ladies to join us at a table decorated with candles, holly bush, and pine. Together, we watched the snow fall and shared gossip. "The fashions in Philadelphia are so daring," Mrs. Monroe said, a little bit scandalized and a little bit delighted. "It's all bare arms and bare bosoms. I hesitate to guess what will be bared next." I laughed. I liked the Monroes. I liked them very much. Together, we visited Philadelphia's famed State House bell in the tower over Independence Hall. We shopped for baubles at the Arcaded Market on High Street. We admired the architecture of the new courthouse. We took our children to the circus together, where acrobats tumbled and clowns made us laugh. And I insisted on having them to the house for dinner, even though my husband grumbled that Monroe had fallen in with the Anti-Federalists. That was true. He'd led them in Virginia, arguing that the Constitution ought not be ratified without a Bill of Rights. But now we had a constitution and a Bill of Rights, and none of it changed the fact that Monroe was our longtime friend. Besides, I held fast to my policy that no man's politics should be held against him at our dinner table. Or I tried to, but circumstances in the months that followed made that increasingly difficult, as the Anti-Federalists coalesced into a political party intent on opposing my husband. But Hamilton was, in those days, an unstoppable force of nature. Some said the most powerful man in the government, with Washington as a mere figurehead, just as my sister had predicted. It wasn't true, but my husband did seem invincible. He'd bargained with Madison and Jefferson to bring his financial system into being. And now there was nothing anyone could do about it, except look for vulnerabilities and petty ways to undermine him. They found this in my father, Senator Philip Schuyler.
The Anti-Federalists found a way to get their revenge, Papa said quietly.
Having moved with us to Philadelphia, quite confident in his re-election to the Senate, Papa now learned of the surprise upset. In the same election that brought James Monroe back into my life as a United States Senator, my father had been defeated, and by, of all people, Aaron Burr. Between our move to Philadelphia, my husband's ascendance in the government, and the Colonel's anti-federalist leanings, we'd grown apart from the Burrs. But that didn't make his opportunism at Papa's expense any less cutting. And to think, my father had given Burr his start.
Another betrayal, my husband raged, his temper as warm as my father's was cool.
And I could not soothe him, because it had begun to feel, even to me, as if we were being abandoned by our friends. Monroe going over to the Anti-Federalists, Madison's reluctant support and increasing preference for Jefferson, Burr's disloyalty. Alexander was not wrong to think this was a strike against him, a shot aimed to remove a solid ally in the Senate and wound him personally besides. But it was my father who was the casualty. Poor Papa, who'd already suffered so much indignity in his public career, was now to be discarded by his nation in the wreath of his venerable age. I was mortified that my father should have to suffer for my husband's ambitions, and at the hands of Colonel Burr, whose wife I'd once counted as my friend and whose family I'd fed at my own table. From the doorway, my 9-year-old son Philip asked,
"What will you do now, Grandpapa?"
It was a question I dared not ask of my 57-year-old father, who had already fought enough battles, political and otherwise, for a lifetime. So I was surprised to see Papa smile as he summoned his grandson forth and ruffled his hair.
"Why, I'll return to Albany and wait for an opportunity to retaliate."
That was Papa's way. He was as patient as a politician as he'd been as a general, taking no time to brood over a lost battle, but slowly and steadily moving to gather allies about him and obstruct his enemy's progress until he was ready for another fight. Unfortunately, patience was very much not my husband's way. With the gratifying support of Madison in Congress, my husband had already moved to levy a tax on whiskey, much needed to fund the government's debts. And we were all relieved that the two architects of the government were once again working in good harmony. But Madison's support was no longer a thing upon which my husband could rely. When Alexander proposed chartering a Bank of the United States, Madison wouldn't go along. Prickling him with every word, my husband explained,
"I think Jefferson has him convinced that by establishing a bank in Philadelphia, I mean to go back on the bargain to move the capital."
It was, of course, an affront to my husband's honor to be thought to have negotiated in bad faith. And I wondered why Mr. Jefferson, so cordial in mixed company, claiming to view us as old friends, would suspect Alexander of perfidy. Perhaps Jefferson's time in the French court had led him to look for intrigue behind every damasked curtain. But there seemed, to me, a remedy that ought to put Jefferson's mind at ease about my husband's intentions. Why not, then, charter the bank on the Potomac?
"We need a bank now," Alexander snapped.
Each new loss of a friend and ally had set him ever more on edge and made him dig in his heels until he was nearly insufferable.
"Madison is a fool not to realize it."
I took a breath and cautioned, "If you express such sentiments in public, of course Madison will oppose your bank. It will be harder for Southerners to invest if it's located in a northern city."
"I don't need Madison or the Southerners."
It unnerved me to hear the hubris in his voice. "Remember, husband,
Madison is the most important man in the Congress. Hamilton's mouth opened as if to list 100 ways in which I was wrong. But then, all at once, his temper broke, and he laughed, drawing me into his arms. "My angel, you are too good and innocent and tender-hearted for me to burden you with this business." His kisses, which rained down upon my face, ought to have been enough to distract me. But something in the way he brushed my concerns aside made me insist. "You need Mr. Madison. You brought the Constitution into existence together, and now you must govern together. You need him." Hamilton's eyes gleamed with triumph.
"I don't. I have the votes, even without your papa in the Senate."
More kisses trailed down my neck.
"So, you see, I don't need Madison, or Monroe, or Jefferson, or Burr. I don't need any of them."
His sense of power and confidence was a heady, erotic thing, and I would be lying to say I didn't feel its intoxicating pull. In truth, my husband seemed drunk on it, turning me in his arms so that I was forced to brace myself against the table. Then he raised my skirts. What he wanted, I knew. I wanted it too. It was not only out of a reluctance for more children that I stopped him. I told myself it was also a concern for decency, that he should try to make love in the middle of the day. But there was something else too. An instinct that he was attempting to master me, and not only for mutual pleasure. I felt suddenly as if, in bending me over this table, I stood in place of all the other frustrations and obstacles in his way. A part of me wished to give in, to be for him a relief and comfort. Certainly, it was my duty as a wife to do so. But I felt some inexplicable assault to my dignity to be taken this way by him in such a mood. "I don't need any of them." There was a recklessness in his words that I felt in his hands, and both unleashed a foreboding in my heart that I wished I'd better heeded. So I turned him away. And perhaps if I hadn't, everything would have been different. February, 1791, Philadelphia.
"I won't be coming to bed tonight,"
Alexander said, scarcely looking up from his desk. He'd been gruff since the afternoon I rebuffed his advances, as if no woman had ever refused him anything before. Or perhaps it was simply that he assumed his wife never would.
"In truth, I doubt I'll come to bed any night this week," he added.
He had an excuse in that President Washington had given him only a week to write up an argument for the necessity and constitutionality of a national bank.
"The president knows perfectly well the necessity," my husband had fumed, "yet he's allowed the Virginians to shake his resolve."
It seemed to me that it was my husband who was shaken, by Mr. Jefferson most of all. Though our tall Virginian Secretary of State spoke eloquently about the ideals of liberty, he was proving to be a stubborn opponent of any practical reforms.
"He's a landed aristocrat who waxes poetic about the virtues of the common man," Hamilton complained, "which might be admirable did he not do it seated in his whirligig chair, sipping the finest wine his inherited wealth can buy, toasting French rioters who shout, 'Death to the rich!'"
My husband didn't trust men who spoke of the glory of the Revolution without having fought in it. Even Madison had volunteered briefly in the militia. But soldier or not, Mr. Jefferson was a formidable foe whose strengths were my husband's weaknesses. Jefferson knew how to employ a wise silence and patience. Meanwhile, my husband took too much for granted that he would have everything his way. He'd even taken for granted his own staggering capacity for hard work. For in writing The Federalist, he'd drawn strength from the collaboration. He'd pushed through his own exhaustion and agonies because he had Madison to commiserate and suffer alongside him. He'd had Madison's intellect to challenge him, and Madison's friendship to encourage him. But now he worked alone. almost as if to punish himself for having allowed anyone to share his burdens, as if to remind himself of the stern lesson of his childhood. He ought never trust or depend upon anyone. Which was why I think he refused even my help, except to say, "Bring me a pot of strong coffee." Some nights it was the only thing he said. At least until, in exhaustion and defeat, he confessed that he wouldn't finish before the president's deadline, a thing that had never happened to him before. I went to where he sat with shoulders bunched in pain and gently took the pen from his palsied hand.
"Betsy, what are you doing?"
"Taking you to bed. In the morning, tell the president that you need another day, and I'll help you." He thanked me with loving gratitude, and when I helped him copy it out the next night, he said all the right words to make me believe he was sincere. He convinced the president. He got his bank. But I think I sensed in him, even then, resentment. Resentment that he hadn't been able to do it himself. That he did need someone, even if it was me. And I believed that's why he sent me and the children away from the heat and bustle of Philadelphia that summer. He insisted, actually. And in those days my husband was not to be denied. Not by Congress, not by the president, and certainly not by me. I'd lived with the consequences of having done it once, and I didn't want to attempt it again. So I spent the summer with my father. That summer. What did Eliza know? That's what everyone wonders. Though no one has ever had the gall to ask. If they did, I'd say I knew nothing, and remembered nothing. That it was all entirely beneath my notice. But now, questions bite at me like insects in the night. Before I left for my father's house, was I there at the table, slicing bread for my children to take on our journey, when the woman came to our door with her sad story? Perhaps I was in the kitchen, setting a kettle to boil. I may have looked up over the wrought iron garden fence to wave to our Quaker neighbor, Dolly Todd, as she passed, and I glimpsed instead an ostentatious woman with golden curls. To explain our unexpected visitor, surely my husband said,
"Just a poor, unfortunate woman, abandoned, in desperate straits."
"And you sent her away?" I would have asked. "Is there nothing to be done to help her?"
"I'll see what I can do,"
he would have replied, kissing our children atop their heads.
"But after dinner."
That's how it started, if the story he told was true. So banal a beginning, it would have escaped my memory. But sometimes I fear that I don't remember it because it never happened the way he said it did. That it never happened that way at all. Chapter 22. September, 1791. Philadelphia. After a blissful summer with my family in Albany, I returned to a new house. Situated just across the street from the president's mansion in Philadelphia, it was bigger and more majestic in every way, with Corinthian pilasters, dentil molding, and arched windows. My new drawing room alone was 25 feet square, and Lady Washington's voice echoed in its empty confines. "How lovely!" It was lovely. It was also more than I thought we could afford on my husband's paltry government salary. But when I expressed this worry, Alexander said he'd taken a loan from Angelica's husband, and that we must keep up appearances. Perhaps Lady Washington agreed, because she leaned in to confide, "I shall be so grateful for you to entertain here in my place." "I could never take your place," I said. Though I knew she was weary and longed for the quiet solitude of Mount Vernon when she confided, "They call me the first lady in the land and think I must be extremely happy, but they might more properly call me the chief state prisoner," I laughed. "Then I certainly would not wish to take your place, even if I could." A sparkle came to her eye. Oh, but you're too young to deny yourself the pleasure. When I was your age, I enjoyed the innocent gaieties of life. Thanks to the kindness of our numerous friends, my new and unwished-for situation is not too much a burden. That is why I am delighted we are closer neighbors. With a little bit of furnishing, this fine new house shall become the social center of the city. Should that prove true, I would rise to the occasion. I'd learned from my mother how to set a fine table and behave with decorum. I'd learned from my sister how to dress and to flatter. I now knew how to preside over a grand salon, and Hamilton expected no less from me. It will need lights, I said fretfully, hoping that my sister could send me elegant chandeliers and torchères from London. Rustic lights and lanterns would not do for the Secretary of the Treasury, for whom our previous abode had become suddenly unbearable. Too small for a growing family, my husband said. Too small for a man of his stature, he meant. A man whose portrait now hung in City Hall. A man whose department of government was growing every day, and whose power grew larger with it. Certainly, my husband's physical stature had become somewhat larger. Sedentary toil had taken its toll. But I rather liked the softer lines of Alexander's face, and the new weight of his arms around me, as if it somehow made his need for me more substantial. In truth, I liked it so well that when the winter's snow came, I wasn't surprised to discover I was again with child. And my husband startled at my suggestion for a name, should it be a boy.
John!
After your friend, I said, gently, hoping to please him. But instead of it drawing him closer to me, he stared into the distance. To prevent the complete retreat that any mention of John Lawrence inevitably occasioned, I quickly added, and after my brother-in-law. If church brings Angelica home, I could forgive him everything. It cannot hurt to remind the man of his family bonds in America. Hamilton nodded slowly.
Clever. I fear I have finally corrupted you and turned you into a politician.
Never, I replied, for I was still sometimes too earnest for the insincerity and idle gossip that served as currency amongst politicians and their wives. I disliked immensely the game I called Who is Out of Fashion, in which the ladies of the town seemed to collectively decide who must be shunned for some embarrassing faux pas, exaggerated slight, or even for wearing the wrong gown. Lady Washington's dignity was such that she transcended the game, and my dear Hamilton teased that I was too much of an angel to know the rules. But I did know the rules of the game. I just didn't wish to play. Especially not now, when my husband was a man of fraying nerves. Darting in and out of the house for meetings at irregular hours, short-tempered with the children, even the girls, whom he doted on. If I didn't know his urgency about the country's business, and a vengeful obsession with keeping Aaron Burr from running for governor of New York, I might have suspected something nefarious afoot. Especially when, one afternoon in December of 1792, my husband advised me not to answer the door to strangers when he wasn't at home. "Are we in some danger?" I asked. Snapping open a gazette, Alexander said,
"It's only that I have enemies in this city who would be happy to abuse my wife's ears, and you're too far gone with child to risk any unhappiness."
I didn't doubt that he had enemies. A new partisan newspaper had been started with, as its sole aim, the destruction of my husband and his policies. And there were whispers that the paper was funded by none other than Mr. Jefferson, though I disbelieved he'd stoop to it. All my husband's plans, all his schemes, were working. The promises of stability and prosperity finally being realized by our countrymen. And yet, the Anti-Federalists saw in him some manner of corrupt, power-hungry upstart, intent upon crushing the rights of our states and enriching the North at the South's expense. They used pseudonyms, but we knew the identity of at least one of the writers because perhaps no one else in the world had better cause to know Madison's writing than we did. And it had crushed Hamilton's spirits to see our old friend's formidable pen turned against us. Still, I didn't fear a little Jemmy Madison coming to my door to berate me. I couldn't even imagine such an absurdity. And if it came to pass, I should have no difficulty driving him off with a frying pan. So I couldn't fathom my husband's fears. "You're sure it's not more than that?"